Meanwhile, another huge protest rally in Washington, D.C. condemned latest Israeli atrocities against Palestinians as hawkish U.S. lawmakers reintroduced the bill supporting the occupying regime. More than 100 pro-Palestinian groups across the United States have sponsored another major protest rally in Washington, D.C. against the Israeli regime's latest terror campaign against the Palestinians. The massive protest march on Saturday, 29th of May, sponsored by Islamic, Palestinian, Arab and human rights groups within the United States, began at the Lincoln Memorial Monument near the State Department and concluded near the U.S. Congress, which has been blocked off by fences and barbed wire since the violent 6th of January attack on the legislative compound by pro-Trump supporters. The recent anti-Israel rally came days after the latest Israeli onslaught against the Palestinian population in the besieged Gaza Strip and other occupied territories concluded with a ceasefire, and followed numerous similar protests held across the United States and other parts of the globe condemning repeated atrocities of the U.S.-sponsored Israeli regime. The rally, dubbed National March for Palestine, also coincides with mounting international pressure against persisting Israeli attacks against Palestinian civilians, particularly Palestinian children, also attacks on hospitals, homes, schools and libraries. Osama Jamal of the United States Council of Muslim Organizations, one of the sponsors of the protest event, said, "We are calling our community and all peace-loving people to march in Washington, D.C. to send a message that the American people are no longer complicit in war crimes being carried out by the Israeli regime." A growing cadre of organizers, led by Muslim and progressive organizations, are uniting in this historic National March for Palestine. At the heels of United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet comments on Thursday, 27th of May, that she has seen no evidence that civilian buildings in the Gaza Strip hit by Israeli airstrikes were being used for military purposes. Dr. Mohsen Ansari, president of the Islamic Circle of North America, added, "In the past 3 weeks, people from across the world have shown unprecedented solidarity and support for the rights of the Palestinian people. This unwavering support from just individuals across the globe has sent a clear message to the Israeli regime and the United States that the atrocities and the killing of innocent civilians, including children, is absolutely unacceptable." Nihad Awad of Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, another sponsor of the rally, said, "We are seeing increasing progress in raising awareness for Congress to better support solutions to protect the legal and human rights of Palestinians." Nihal Awad added, "At the same time, we have witnessed the continued reluctance in the Biden administration to hold Israel accountable for its war crimes in the Gaza Strip or uphold American values by demanding an end to evictions of Palestinians in the city of Al-Quds." The protest march is part of a new national Sanction Israel campaign calling on pro-Israel Biden administration and Congress to sanction the Israeli regime and stop giving it billions of U.S. tax dollar and military hardware, like the very same bombs that the hawkish regime just used to obliterate entire Palestinian families in the Gaza Strip. This is while Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, along with 15 other fellow right-wing lawmakers, reintroduced legislation on Friday, 28th of May, that would impose sanctions on individuals and entities that support the Gaza-based Hamas resistance group or other Palestinian organizations. A press release issued by Marco Rubio's office proclaimed on Friday, "This bill would impose sanctions against foreign individuals, entities and governments that provide support to Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement and other Palestinian groups." The bill, titled the Palestinian International Terrorism Support Prevention Act, also requires the U.S. president to submit an assessment to Congress regarding whether other countries are doing enough to counter the fundraising, financing, money laundering, and other forms of support for Palestinian groups. Marco Rubio, the vice chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and ranking member of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, led the bill's reintroduction, citing the need to uphold supporters of such organizations accountable following the encounter between Israeli regime forces and Palestinian resistance groups that led to the massacre of more than 270 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and in the city of Al-Quds, including many Palestinian women and children.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic law.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanted whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance, and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaikum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Welcome back. You are listening to Islamic Laws from IRIB English Radio. Sheikh Javid, the first question of today's program is about one of the customs among the Shias during the month of Muharram and Safar, especially these 2 months, the concept that is called Tahziyah in some cultures, or reenacting the event of Ashura. We know that, people in some plays try to reenact the event to show, for example, what happened during the day of Tasu'a, the 9th of Muharram, the night before that, and especially what happened during the day of Ashura. Now, first of all, the first question is, what is the Islamic law, the fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei, about this ta'ziyah in and of itself, about reenacting the event of Ashura?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, let me just give a general answer from the viewpoint of Shi'i scholars, and then I'll come to Ayatollah Khamenei's standpoint regarding ta'ziyah or reenactment of the event of Ashura. Well, according to the Shi'i religious authorities, there is no objection whatsoever about the reenactment in and of itself. Because it's a good reminder, it has a profound impact on the minds and hearts of the people, and it actually reminds people of the event of Karbala and what happened and the atrocities that took place on that day. The religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have said that it should be divide of any, let's say, lies or exaggerations, mm-hmm. Because that is not going to serve the purpose. It will destroy the image of the not only Ashura but the entire religion. So,
I believe it's like any other text, any lecture, which needs to be based on the authentic accounts in the history and narrations. The same is true about this ta'ziyah as well.
Of course, the same is true about the reenactments taking place during Muharram and Safar. You know, sometimes there might be some people who might want to exaggerate or add something to the accounts without even making sure whether such things might have taken place or whether they are authentic or not. They might make some allegations which are not based on any reports, and they are not authenticated. And therefore, what concerns and what worries the religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is that someone and some people might want to exaggerate, might want to make some false claims, or forge some things, fabricate some stories, and then narrate those stories to the people, to the audience, creating some false impression. Okay, mm-hmm. That is not permissible according to all religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. So, if one is very much sure that his story or that the reenactment is based on authentic reports found in the books written and authored by prominent Shiite scholars, there's no problem.
Yeah, that's true, but the other question that might be asked is the fact that, you know, sometimes we read an event in the history. It is based on, for example, the book Al-Luhuf or Maqtal al-Husayn, Maqtal al-Khwarizmi, and so on and so forth. Now, the point is that when we want to put it in a kind of scenario for the tazia, for the play, in a poetic form, then we may not exactly quote what, for example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam said. We might paraphrase it. We do not change, but we do not quote exactly his words. Because when it comes to poetic forms, we know that there are some requirements.
Sure.
So is it also problematic for, I mean, to narrate the same story, the same event, but with, alternative words?
You're right. As you rightly mentioned, it's not possible to narrate the exact words of the infallible imams, including Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, and also the sayings of the Holy Prophet and those of his righteous successors. It's not possible. So therefore, the purport of the those narrations or the significations of those narrations are put in the words of the eulogist or the person who is actually conducting the reenactment ceremony. So there's no objection whatsoever when it comes to paraphrasing or giving the report with the words.
As long as there is no exaggeration,
of course, as long as there's no false claims or no false things attributed to those noble figures.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you?
Another question which is related to mourning for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam during the month of Muharram and Safar is the fact that we know that in many mourning processions, people carry some flags. And on it, there are some, sentences about the importance of the month of Muharram or about Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his words, or the names of the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Now, first of all, is it, religiously speaking, permitted for the Muslims, for the Shia, to carry these flags? And second of all, what is the ruling on kissing these flags by the people? Because of the fact that this is related to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, some people are interested in touching and kissing these flags. So is it permitted according to the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei?
Well, according to His Eminence, it is permissible to carry such flags, and it's also permissible to kiss those flags, as long as one does not consider such practices as a part of the religion. That is the point made by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, because one should not stress on considering these things as a part of the religion. Okay, these are practices which are allowed in and of itself. They are allowed per se, but Ayatollah Khamenei says that one should not consider such practices as being part of the religion. As far as
the intention matters, because we are doing that to show again our respect, our love,
and
maybe sometimes we through these flags we narrate the whole message of the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes, and kissing, of course, kissing these flags is also permissible, because these flags are somehow related to the flag of the flag carried by Abu al-Fazl al-Abbas alayhi salatu wasalam on the day of Ashura. So because it's somehow related to that important event, we don't believe at all that these are the flags we are carrying on the day of Ashura are the same flags carried by those noble figures. But it's just a reminder of those flags. It's somehow related to those to that very important event. And there's no objection to kissing them. It's not considered to be shirk also, because many people, the Wahhabis, claim that it's a kind of shirk. It's never. We don't kiss it with the intention of, let's say, associating it with Allah or considering it as a partner for Allah. It's not shirk at all.
Yeah, when the shirt of Joseph, Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, is holy for his father.
Yes, you're right.
It's not because of its clothes. It is because of the fact that it is related to a holy personality like
Yusuf alayhi
salam. You're right.
That's a good point. A very powerful example that you gave.
Sheikh Javid, unfortunately, we are running out of time. Again, I would like to thank you for your presence in this program. And again, I would like to express my condolences for these sad days of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Inshallah, we'll continue answering these questions in the following session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iraq and Syria have been struggling with poverty and instability for years. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and Washington and its allies' support for opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, as well as crippling economic sanctions, merely added fuel to the fire of instability there and gave birth to Daesh. Since Daesh terrorists emerged in Iraq and Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. On August 7, 2017, Daesh terrorists captured a member of an Iranian advisory support team in Syria near the Taif border crossing in the southeast of the country. 2 days later, on August 9, Mohsen Hojaji was beheaded by the Takfiri terrorists. The terrorist group published photos and videos of Hojaji's arrest and beheading. The act prompted widespread condemnation of the terrorist group, as well as the admiration of the soldiers who were fighting against it. In a meeting with the family of Hojaji, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei hailed Hojaji as an emblem of sincere and courageous martyrdom and called the Takfiri groups puppets of the United States and Britain. Also, late Iranian commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Qasem Soleimani, slammed the incident as a horrific, inhuman crime that came in the wake of successive blows dealt on several fronts to Takfiri Wahhabi terrorist groups, which are linked to the world's imperialist power. He vowed not to rest until they have taken out every last terrorist from the face of the Muslim world. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, who played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists, were assassinated in Baghdad airport in January 2020 in a U.S. drone attack. Two years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took the lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos that resulted from the U.S. invasion finally gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011, that later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. Add to this list the crippling sanctions against the Damascus government. The U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socio-economic conditions there.
First of all, let's say Iran is supporting all the freedom fighters in the world and fighting against the terrorists. Even, you know, like we call it, either we call it Hujaija massacre, brutal killing by ISIS, and then al-Nusra later on. As we know that those movements, let's say, or organizations, according to what Hillary Clinton said, this is, or they were all created by United States.
Washington is directly responsible for the emergence of Daesh and the current instability and poverty that has afflicted the Iraqi and Syrian nations. Ironically, the U.S. punishes countries that are aiding Baghdad and Damascus to fight the Takfiri terrorists with economic sanctions and calls them terrorists. Aren't the real terrorists those who provide assistance for Daesh and worsen the living conditions of people by imposing economic sanctions on their countries? In a statement released on Saturday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry commemorated the Iranian diplomats and a journalist who were killed at the Consulate General of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, in August 1998. The Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned the terrorist attack, saying it was against all international laws and treaties. The body also announced that different aspects of the attack are required to be clarified, and this is a definite demand of the government and people of Iran. 23 years ago, the Taliban captured Mazar-e-Sharif. After that, the group admitted that 10 Iranian diplomats and a journalist had been killed during an attack on the Iranian consulate. The Taliban spokesman said the Iranians had been killed by renegade forces who had acted without orders. Furthermore, the ministry reiterated its call on all parties to the war in Afghanistan to end the conflict and seek a solution in the negotiations. That's why the UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has warned that the country is heading toward a, quote, catastrophe.
In the past weeks, the war in Afghanistan has entered a new, deadlier, and more destructive phase. The Taliban campaign during June and July to capture rural areas has achieved significant territorial gains. From this strengthened position, they have begun to attack the larger cities.
The Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban has also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials. The US B-52 bombers and Spectre gunships have reportedly targeted Taliban positions in northern Afghanistan. While there has been no confirmation of the airstrikes or possible damage by Taliban militants, Afghan Defense Ministry has declared that the airstrikes inflicted significant damage to the militants. The deployment of American bombers and gunships further highlights the degree of dependency of Afghan forces on US military support. Also, the development has further raised questions about the reliability of persistent claims made over the years by the US and NATO forces in Afghanistan, that they have primarily been engaged in training Afghan government forces to independently safeguard the country's security against various threats. Meanwhile, the airstrikes came as the militants advanced towards key cities. On Friday, the Taliban captured the capitals of two Afghan provinces in a matter of 24 hours, the city of Shebirghan in Jawzjan and the city of Zarangi in Nimruz.
Of course, the Taliban cannot be expected to provide security to the embassies and diplomats of other countries. And as you mentioned, the incident of what happened at the Iranian embassy and the killing of Iranian diplomats was a very tragic event. But what more can we expect from Taliban? If you look at Taliban's history, if you look at Taliban's rule in Afghanistan, it's a rule of destruction, of violence and suppression. And I'm afraid we are again heading back into the situation.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122-caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of that practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for the sick political Zionist project. They try everything to forbid building a civil state, because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the Sikh ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabih Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. Managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing, is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process. Raisi is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4-year terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal US sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
The Lies.
Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into her obsession, an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Sorry, are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery bosses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tip sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of 2 baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost 8 of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst the wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number 2.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app, and it can help you determine this, how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabli is not perfect, though, and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice. Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent, as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalist usually frees the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. A vertical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8-tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. The air quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. The air is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar green housing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world, known as Van Gogh Live, the experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to COVID-19.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. But of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses, with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience, was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.